And just as a beginning set of for some assistance, and that phone number is 503-235-5474. That's 503-235-5474. And as we close the show, I want to encourage people to reach out and connect with each other across lines of gender, economy, education, race, everything, so that we can become better connected and we can become each other's keeper and sharer of life. This is your Community Connection, KBOO Portland.
Every Monday night at 8 o'clock, you can hear this voice alerting you that
you are about to cross the border.
And then follow the footsteps to a two-hour-long sustained environment of uninterrupted sonic art or new electronic, experimental, or postmodern music. Audio that breaks and rewrites the rules to create entirely new worlds of sound. Where will you be on Mondays at 8 when the door slams shut? Here on KBOO Portland.
Down. You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. The time is just after 9 o'clock on March 9th. I'm Joe Clement, your host and engineer for today. The Old Mole is a political magazine for your ears. From week to week, we bring you interviews with thinkers and doers, book and movie reviews, analyses of the ideologies of both oppression and liberation, poetry and music, and our own kind of commentary, the well-read red. We're a collective of agitators, organizers, artists, and educators who believe the life of the mind, like the rest of the material world, belongs to everyone. Today's show starts with Bill Resnick continuing a conversation he started with Al Weinrub last week about what really counts as clean energy and how cities can lead the way in cutting carbon outputs. It's the second Monday of the month, which means Alan Weider is back with another documentary on radical radio commentator, oral historian, and playwright Studs Terkel. This month, we hear about the Wobblies and working-class intellectuals that inspired and influenced Studs. Fran Michel brings us The Well-Read Red. This week, she considers why capitalism cannot actually provide affordable housing and why affordable housing might not even be what we really want if what we want is housing for all. Finally, to wrap up our show, Jan Hawken interviews film director Karen Wechter about Sisterhood of Night, a feminist-inspired mystery drama about a group of girls who form a secret society. You can watch the film at the Hollywood Theater on Thursday, March 12th, the opening night of the Portland, Oregon Women's Film Festival. In that vein, in honor of International Women's Day, which was yesterday, the musical interludes we hear today are by or about women. You can find past shows and segments in our archive at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. There we post the show within a few days of broadcast, which you can download or listen to in your browser. Find out about upcoming shows by checking that page a few days ahead of time or following us on Facebook. Lastly, if you'd like to contribute the show, we'll teach you the ropes. Just email us at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com or call the station at 503-231-8032 and leave us with a way to get in touch with you. And now we turn to the second part of Bill Resnick's talk with Al Weinrub. Al Weinrub is a physicist and coordinates the Bay Area Local Clean Energy Alliance and wrote the book Community Power: Decentralized Clean Energy in California. In the first part of their talk from last week, they discussed how community-produced, small-scale network energy production differs from big corporate energy production, even when it's solar and wind. In this second talk, they discuss how communities around the world are actually attempting to create these networks and the barriers they face.
Al Weinrub, tell us how local decentralized energy systems, how can they be developed? What are the instruments for developing local clean energy?
Well, the instruments for developing local clean energy are mostly political instruments or organizing instruments, so you might say, because the technologies are all here and have been for a long time. But the problem is that there are a lot of institutional barriers for being able to do this. The main institutional barrier is that the large utilities and the large energy industry don't favor that kind of development. In fact, they oppose it. So at the federal, state, and to the extent possible at the local level, they push for policies that make it very difficult to what I would call democratize the energy system. I can give you an example. In California, a bill was passed in 2002 called the Community Choice Aggregation Bill. What it really means is that a city or a group of cities or a county can aggregate all their customers and procure electricity on behalf of them instead of the utility playing that role. So it basically takes the decision about where electricity is going to come from away from the utility and puts it in the hands of a public agency. So we call it a community choice energy program. And in California, this bill was passed, as I said, in 2002, and this is now 2015. And there's only two functioning community choice energy programs in California, one in Marin County and one in Sonoma County. And now there's about a dozen such programs that are being initiated. I mean, people at the local levels and every place from San Diego to Santa Barbara through San Luis Obispo and up into the Bay Area, San Francisco and Oakland and every place else have initiatives to try to put community choice energy in place. So aside from a proposition that PG&E, that's the biggest utility in California, put on the ballot in 2010, which was meant to kill community choice energy, and they lost that one. It was a David and Goliath struggle. They put up $50 million and still lost. But most recently in the legislature, they put up another bill, which would have had the intent of killing community choice energy programs as well. And they were even able to get the building trades unions on their side. So you basically had the largest utilities and the California Labor Federation out to kill community-based energy procurement under this law by killing the law, effectively killing the law. So that's the type of thing that local activists are up against, is that the most powerful institutions in the state are there trying to make it almost impossible to institute these programs. I should just say, we beat them again. We organized a coalition called the Californians for Energy Choice, and we mobilized 200 organizations, and we did everything, and essentially the bill never made it out of the Senate, the California Senate. So that was a great victory. But it's just an example of what I'm talking about when I say that all the institutional arrangements make it difficult to move forward. All the ways that you might possibly think of financing this stuff at a more local level, you run into Securities and Exchange Commission regulations. Raising money is difficult because large investors, I mean, that's really not where their bread is buttered, let's say. So it's difficult. I mean, most of even the behind-the-meter energy development, meaning stuff that people build on buildings, both residential and commercial buildings, I mean, a lot of that stuff that's being built is being built through leasing companies so that individual property owners don't have to come up with the investment that's needed to build this stuff in the first place. So instead, you have these systems built and then you lease them to very large organizations, Solar City and, you know, really big producers who essentially own these facilities instead of them being owned in the community. So if there were policies that made it very easy to borrow the money that you need to put solar on your roof, a lot of people would be doing it and they would be owning it and they would be getting the benefits. And then they would really promote it to their neighbors and everybody else. And schools would use it and flourish that way. And public buildings and everything else. But the financing of this stuff is extremely difficult. And all the incentives, for example, require that you have huge tax liability because the incentives are largely based on tax rebates. So if you don't pay tax because you're not a profit-making organization, you don't really get much benefits from that. So the whole system is what I'm saying is structured to discourage a more democratized approach to energy development.
You know, California has, I read, over 100,000 now solar installations, although many of them, I suspect, are the leased installations where people really aren't involved at all. They just use their part of their property for them. It seems to me there is a base in California, and you were able to defeat that utilities initiative and then their effort to push a bill through the California legislature. It seems to me there really is a base of support for community energy in California. I'm wondering if you could use that base of support for some kind of initiative, let's say, or to really expand community energy and develop the financing. Is Tom Steyer there with his money ready to support that initiative?
Tom Steyer. Yeah, he is here. And you're right. Maybe relative to other places, there is a relatively strong base for this. And I should say that base is largely in low-income communities and communities of color. These are the folks who really understand environmental and climate justice questions and who have been pretty much closed out of the big monopolized energy system and who understand that if they can develop on a community level energy resources, then that's going to help empower their communities. I should just say that the Local Clean Energy Alliance that I coordinate has an annual conference called Clean Power Healthy Communities. And that conference is dedicated to this whole concept that local renewable energy can be a source of empowerment for communities, especially those that have been written off by our current economic and political system. So, yes, there is a base for this type of development. It's also true that in that community, there are a whole lot of ways that they are being assaulted. Everything from the police, who routinely, well, we know the national movement of an opposition to the kind of brutality, racist brutality that's going on, to lack of jobs and everything else. I mean, it's sort of a whole package. So that talking about renewable energy, unless it's seen, you know, as an economic development platform, is not on the top of many people's agenda. But that is the way we try to talk about it, as an economic development platform. And in fact, we are trying to do exactly, to the extent that people are organized around this idea, are trying to do exactly what you're saying. So these dozen or so initiatives around the state that are trying to institute community choice energy programs, that is largely the agenda. It's to rally local support for a superior form of energy development that'll benefit their communities. So that is what's being worked on, but you do have to understand that there are still very powerful forces that have a lot of influence. For example, when you talk about just sort of a community or a public agency taking over energy procurement, I mean, it's very hard for people to understand that, number one, private corporate enterprise is not the most efficient and effective way of achieving human needs. A lot of skepticism about the ability of government institutions to act effectively. And, you know, I mean, that's because they've been deprived of all resources in a very categorical and planned way by people with power. So, you know, there's sort of a lot of skepticism, say, about the possibility of doing this. I mean, what you see more likely and more often is that small community groups try to get together to figure out some way of financing and developing local renewables on a smaller scale than an entire city. So in the United States, we have what's called a network called the Community Power Network. It's based out of Washington, D.C., but it's basically a network of many, many different kinds of organizations who have said, well, despite all these barriers, we're going to try to figure out a way how we can build solar PV installation on a church or in our community or in our neighborhoods and so on and so forth. So there is a lot of activity on that level, but it is very difficult at this point in time to get financing for these kinds of things. The financial markets just do not favor them. So there's always talk and possibilities of things like a state renewable energy development bank, you know, that could be used to finance this kind of stuff and whatnot. But as soon as you get into the legislature to try to enact something like this, you end up having to deal with a system of government that's been totally corrupted by big money already. And that's why most of this work takes place at the local and municipal level. However, the kind of financial resources that have to come to bear rarely reside at the local level. So it's tricky. We're definitely not writing it off, but it is a big challenge.
One final issue, Al. It's going to be a while before the American people wake up to the fact that their future, and particularly their children's future, is deeply compromised and imperiled by global warming. And that, in fact, we may be in a world where production of food and just the most basic necessities are so compromised that we find ourselves fighting over whatever resources are left. A murderous situation that, in fact, could ultimately, when it all plays out, make a world that's uninhabitable. Al, but at some point there's going to be signs of that happening when Long Island gets flooded or Southern Florida disappears or New Orleans disappears or huge droughts drive people out of vast areas in both the United States and Africa and other places, or the glaciers all disappear and communities depending on glacier water are decimated. A number of those things happening, huge storms destroying infrastructure, and which then becomes non-reconstructable. At some point, people are going to realize that something really has to be done. And at that point, if we can demonstrate in some cities and many localities the feasibility, the cheapness, the quickness of moving towards localized energy and an energy reduction, our task right now focuses on not winning all of these struggles, but being able to demonstrate our capacities to reduce global warming to manageable levels. Comment on that hypothesis.
Well, my main reaction is that the scenario that you're talking about is not very far off in the future. In fact, we've seen this stuff in action. I mean, you talked about Long Island being underwater. Well, it was underwater in the Rockaways, you know, just recently.
Right.
And in those places where that's happened, I mean, there has been quite a transformation in the way people start to think about things, sort of verifying what you're saying, but and not quite getting to the answer quite yet. But New York State just banned fracking, and this is a momentous move by the governor of New York State. And this happened largely because of Hurricane Sandy. And what happened, which sort of changed the whole political climate there, when the big mobilization took place in New York City in September of 400,000 people marching in the streets, there was a significant number of labor unions that were in the lead of that march. And those unions, to a large extent, were New York unions. And those unions that had felt the impact of that storm in real ways, because they were service workers or hospital workers or places like that. And so this notion that the climate is something that we have to change our policies and we have to change the way we do things, it does happen. The question is whether we can set up models that demonstrate the alternative way of doing things in time to attract popular support before the big disasters hit. And I mean, the jury is definitely out on that one, especially in a situation where you have the most right-wing forces in the country organized by the Koch brothers and other places having captured the Congress of the United States. And the first bill on their agenda was the Keystone Pipeline, because they really understand that in order to deal with climate, you have to basically reorganize society in a way that's not going to be good for globalized capitalism. Let's just call it what it is. And that's who's funding that whole right-wing movement. The cards are not stacked well in our favor in terms of national or state institutions. So it really does depend upon people at the local level having their understanding what's going on, having their heads straight, and thinking about this stuff in a very broad way. And there's now a term that has a lot of currency. It's called community resilience. And it's this notion that, okay, we've accepted the fact that the calamities are about to happen or are on their way or are already happening, and we have to figure out how to fortify our communities so that they can be strong against the impact of everything that climate change is going to deliver. You know, the things that you mentioned, the shortages of food, increased prices, actual physical attack on the environment through rising seas and weather. But it's sort of interesting that there is a fight now about what community resilience means. So the establishment takes community resilience to mean fortifying the commercial infrastructure and bringing in homeland security to make sure that the rebellion that takes place when people are assaulted by the climate and the institutions of the state, how to quell that. You know, so a lot of money and institutional power being put into creating the coercive power of the state to try to build these infrastructures that will withstand climate change, at the same time, all at the expense of the communities in which we live. So there's a struggle going on now to define community resilience as strengthening our communities on the local level through developing local renewable energy, local food systems, being able to harness water, being able to build social infrastructures and all those kinds of things that are required in order to survive the kinds of assaults that are coming on down. So I think that there is definitely activity and a consciousness around a lot of this stuff. But having the models that demonstrate the success, we're not there yet. It takes a lot of work to create them, a lot of organizing to build them, and a lot of vision to understand what's necessary.
Al, I want to thank you. We'll conclude that way. Thanks for the good work. You emphasized that it all has to be done quickly. This must be, in some ways, just for a second, really frustrating for you. You see the sort of the imminence of really catastrophic, lethal events plunging the planet into enormous misery, worse in the third, in the South and in the global North, I suppose, but threatening everybody, and it's slow going right now. So thank you for your work, and you get the last word.
Well, thanks for the opportunity to talk about this stuff. I hope people might have a chance to read Naomi Klein's new book, This Changes Everything, about where the problem really lies, and by implication, the kind of organizing and reliance on each other that we're going to need in order to move beyond this situation.
Al Weinrub, thanks a lot for talking to us.
You're welcome. Thanks again.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Joe Clement, your host. Today's show started with Bill Resnick and Al Weinrub finishing their talk from last week about community versus corporate energy production. The music we just heard was Hazel Dickens singing Joe Hill's song The Rebel Girl, which he wrote in no small part about Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, who as a teenager was an outspoken socialist feminist and full-time organizer with the Industrial Workers of the World. She was also a founding member of the American Civil Liberties Union and advocated vociferously for birth control, women's suffrage, and other rights. As mentioned, yesterday was International Women's Day, which was first observed in 1909 as a political event organized by the Socialist Party of America in remembrance of a strike that happened the year before by the International Lady Garments Workers Union. I guess you could say that makes the song fitting. We now turn to Alan Weeder, who looks at the influence of Wobblies and working-class intellectuals on legendary radio commentator and oral historian Studs Terkel.
Today's segment portrays the early political influences on Studs Terkel's life, especially his devotion to labor, his lifelong struggle against class disparity, and his support of progressive and third-party politics. Studs Terkel was born in 1912. One of his many shticks was, "I came up the year the Titanic went down." Memories of the first 10 years of his life as a boy in New York are found in all of his memoirs, as well as in the introduction to Will the Circle Be Unbroken? Asthmatic as a child, Studs continued to struggle with health issues into his teenage years. His family moved to Chicago when he was 9 years old, and his parents managed a men's hotel, the Wells Grand, that was located in the Tower Town section of the city. Franklin Rosemont described the neighborhood in his introduction to the book Hobohemia as a place characterized, above all, by its heady mix of radical politics and cultural nonconformity. He referred to the neighborhood as working class and politically revolutionary. Institutions included the Radical Bookshop, where Wobbly leader Big Bill Haywood and Carl Sandburg played chess, Studio Players, which was a progressive theater, Ben Reitman's Hobo College, the Dill Pickle Club, and of course, Bughouse Square. And they all flavored Studs' youth. He often commented on the great influence the Depression had on his life, and certainly his book Hard Times, published in 1970, powerfully told the story of devastation and the impact that Americans carried throughout their lives. For Studs, this period also represented his enculturation into the importance of both conversation and politics. He was greatly affected by the discussions and debates in the lobby of the Wells Grand. Beginning in 1925, Studs made the effort to know the people who inhabited the hotel lobby. He wrote of their stories in his various biographical books, and their lives illustrate the humanity of working men. In the lobby, evenings, Saturdays, and Sundays, the card game stopped as questions of world politics, natural science, the occult arts, and human behavior took center stage. Studs was most intrigued by the debates between the Wobblies and what some of the tenants referred to as company men.
150 years old. And so, in a sense, you have now my hearing impairment and my confession. And now we begin. Now I've
You ready for the next question?
Yes.
I think with that soliloquy, people have a sense of your extraordinary mind. Now, as I went through and prepared for this, it struck me that there are two influences that really were your education. One was your mother's hotel and listening to all those voices there. Tell us a little about that. How did that affect you?
You see, I was more than University of Chicago Law School, let me tell you that. The hotel was a men's hotel during the Great American Depression, but this is before the Depression. Now, the hotel was not a flop house. It was skilled guys, retired firemen, boomer firemen. Many of them were Wobblies, IWW, you know, who believed in one big union. Other guys were pro-boss, and so they'd have arguments back and forth. They called the Wobblies IWW, meaning I won't work. You know, that was the thing. Whereas the other guys called these guys who said the boss is there because he earned it. Remember John Houseman's commercial that he said, they earned it because they earned it. And so the Wobblies, as the IWW were known, called these guys scissor bills or capitalists with holes in their pocket. And so I used to hear these arguments. The thing we miss today is argument. We miss debate. We missed the whole idea of people going back and forth, and I loved hearing those arguments. Many were autodidacts. They were self-taught. They carried little blue books. They were called E. Haldeman and Julius Blue Books. They cost a nickel and a dime, printed in Girard, Kansas. And it'd be works of Shakespeare. It'd be the works of Clarence Darrow defending people.
The experiences at the Wells Grand, as well as Bughouse Square, shaped Studs Terkel's lifelong support of labor, as well as his fight against class disparity and racism in the United States. Roberta Lynch, the executive director of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees in Illinois, said of Studs, "One of the really amazing things about him was the tremendous respect that he had for working people, which you just didn't encounter very much in our culture. Many, many people who think they're liberal or progressive are actually contemptuous of or indifferent to working people. And Studs just recognized the incredible talent and intellect that there is in the ranks of any, almost any, group of workers that you could find. Buckhouse Square was a place that Studs truly loved. In fact, when he died on Halloween 2008, his ashes, mixed with his wife Ida's, were buried under a tree in the park. Buckhouse Square was his political link from adolescence to adulthood. The scene provided Studs with an introduction to anarchist, socialist, and communist oratory. Progressive ideas of all sectors were proclaimed at Buckhouse Square. Studs listened to Lucy Parsons, the wife of Haymarket martyr Albert Parsons, and Ben Reitman, lifelong anarchist who was Emma Goldman's comrade and lover. Speakers roared against the Haymarket Affair, American capitalism, and world imperialism. Studs often referenced Haymarket.
Well, Haymarket is always there. The ghost of Haymarket is never quite laid. The ghost of Haymarket is always there, Chicago and then. Because it dealt with labor primarily. It dealt with equity primarily. Remember, it was a fight for the eight-hour day. We think about that throughout the world. That case, of course, resonated. The indignation was there, as you know, people like Tolstoy and Bernard Shaw all spoke out against it, and William Morris all spoke, and William Dean Howells did. I'm not sure if Mark Twain did or not. He didn't. But there they were, and the Chicago industrialists, one of the spokesmen was a very enlightened one named Lyman Gage. He said, maybe we should commute the sentence. They weren't there, and they all agreed except for one industrialist, Marshall Field I, flowing white mustache, distinguished merchant prince. He said, hang the bastards. And they did. Four were hanged. And later on, of course, the greatest perhaps of all governors any state ever had, John Peter Altgeld, looked over the records and says, this was a frame-up, this was a farce. And those who survived, the three of the four who survived, he pardoned, much to the destruction of his political career.
Franklin Rosemont referred to Buckhouse Square as the most celebrated outdoor free speech forum in the entire country, where leading soapboxers harangued eager crowds that often numbered in the thousands, night after night, weather permitting. And Lucy Parsons was known as Chicago's best-known anarchist. Studs spoke about Buckhouse as well as Lucy Parsons for Media Burn.
1935-36, the Depression, there was Buckhouse Square in Chicago. Buckhouse Square is an area devoted to free speech ever since the beginning. It's opposite the Newberry Library in Chicago. It's near North Side. It's a little park and square. And during its golden days, the 20s and 30s, before World War II, and certainly before television, there were speakers there on summer nights and spring nights. There were five soapboxes. And everybody, and they all had a chance to speak. They worked out. It was sort of a production. Communists spoke, anarchists, wobblies, IWW, religious people, Moody Bible, Sky Pilots, they were told, a woman singing hymns, someone selling books on sex hygiene. And they were the key speakers. They were the stars. Often they were heckled, and of course they were masters at answering hecklers. But the one I remember so graphically was this little old lady, light-skinned black woman, Lucy Parsons, the widow of Albert Parsons, who lived for a long, long time. Imagine poverty to a great extent. And Lucy Parsons would speak on occasion, recall the event, but still speak about events of the moment, fighting the Depression in favor of Social Security, whatever it was in those days, unemployment compensation, fighting the idea of capitalism. And Lucy Parsons spoke. I remember she was fervent. And I remember she wore a flowered hat. I'll never forget that. That's the part I remember most. A flowered hat for the occasion. And later on, when the orators get off their soapboxes, the hat is passed. They pass the hat. Nickels and dimes are tossed in. And Lucy's hat was being passed around. And the guy next to me, who lived at the hotel, was an old-time wobbly IWW guy named Sprague,
who lost his teeth. He was beaten up one day by vigilantes up in Seattle during the general strike. And old Sprague came to him. He took a dollar, one big dollar out of his pocket and dropped it in Lucy Parsons' hat. Now, a buck to him was like 150 bucks to someone today. $200, you see. So I remember that. But she spoke there. The men, many didn't know who she was, but quickly the word spread about something called Haymarket.
Supporting third-party politics was a constant for Studs. In 1924, he attended a rally with his father for Progressive Party presidential candidate Robert Fighting Bob La Follette's running mate, Burton Wheeler, whom Studs later interviewed for his book Hard Times. When he interviewed Hank Ottinger for the same book, Ottinger spoke of his father being an admirer of La Follette. Quote, in 1924, my mother said to my father, you know, La Follette isn't going to win the presidency. Why don't you vote for somebody who can win it? He said, I vote for what I believe in. Studs echoed those words throughout his life. He went on to work for Henry Wallace in 1948, and his last favorite candidate was Dennis Kucinich. On the 2000 Nation magazine cruise, Studs joined Victor Novosky, Patricia Williams, Erica Alterman, Larry Goodwin, and the late Molly Ivins on a Ralph Nader panel. Responding to Alterman, Studs spoke on the need for third-party politics.
Everything Eric says is factually true, but Nader is not the issue. I think we're wrong. Nader, the person, is a flawed being. Gloria Steinem described him as having a De Gaulle complex. I think it was a touch of Coriolanus in him. That is, Coriolanus, Shakespeare's protagonist, was anti-populist, of course. Nader is populist. Populist, he had something called hubris. That is, he was rigid in his self-righteousness, but he was right on all the issues. Nader is not the issue. He's secondary to the fact that those 10,000 kids were there, 12,000 kids, a whole new generation I call Generation Y. They're the kid sisters, kid brothers of what we label Generation X, solipsistic and self-centered, or the kids of the boomers, solipsistic. As a whole new generation that's hungry beyond what Gore and beyond what each of those parties represent, because who runs them? It is not John Conyers and company who runs them. It's, we come back to the same old, the virus that runs them. Remember, that's what it's all about. These kids are hungry. They're a whole new generation who've broken through the miasma of this matter of the third party meaning nothing but two major. Of course, there's got to be a third force of some sort. That's what elected Harry Truman. That's what could have elected Al Gore. It's as though Dr. Nader is a quack doctor. He was offering a prescription there that was not taken, and the patient died. So you blame the doctor for not taking his prescription. So Nader's not the issue. You're right, and factually right, but you're truthfully wrong. Because the issue is the movement itself and not Ralph Nader.
There's so much more to say about the foundations of Studs Terkel's political life. Next month, we will continue the conversation discussing the roots and actions of his lifelong campaign against white supremacy. Again, thanks to Media Burn in Chicago for their productions. This is Alan Weider for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Oh, I ain't got a home, I'm just rambling all around. Just a wandering worker, I go from town to town. And the police make it hard wherever I may go. I ain't got no home in this world anymore. My brothers and my sisters are stranded on this road. A hot and dusty road.
I'm Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and that's about the prettiest version of Woody Guthrie's Ain't Got No Home that I'd ever heard before, sung by a woman from Arkansas, I believe, named Gina Galena, playing the banjo. Before that, we heard Alan Weider with another documentary piece on the life and times of Studs Terkel. As Woody himself might put it, it's a funny world we're living in. Scientists are predicting massive droughts the likes of which we haven't seen since the Dust Bowl, and the rich men are still taking people's homes and driving them from their doors. It happened to me just the year before last. And if you ever thought to take the chance and raise your voice and say, "No, this is my home," you might be told you have the wrong idea about how this world works, or you may be shouted down or just ignored. And for those who are not able to land on their feet like I was fortunate enough to, the police are still making it hard. So today's well-read read by Fran Michel hits mighty close to home. She considers why housing justice hasn't been achieved under capitalism, what housing justice is when reasonably and humanely considered, and last but not least, what kind of direct collective action will actually get us the goods.
Good morning. The well-read read has some readings on housing. First, from a 1946 New International essay by Miriam Gould on profits and the housing crisis, conflicting interests of banks, industry, and real estate. Quote, "Way back in 1872, Friedrich Engels made three generalizations about housing under capitalism that remain the key to analysis of the problem today. First, he said, all the sermons liberals and reformists preach to capital about the profitability of low-cost housing are a waste of time. Capital has ignored the mass housing field because greater profits are to be made elsewhere, and profits, not human need, are the sole criteria of whether capitalism produces. Second, the problem of housing is subordinate to the basic question of income distribution. Until the unjust and evil system we have today is ended, planned, healthful living in cooperative, functional, truly human communities is impossible. Third, the general problem of housing can never be solved without resolving the antithesis between town and country. Translated into simple terms, mass housing is impossible without city planning and socialist, regional, and national economic planning." End quote. Next, from a 2014 Jacobin essay by Samuel Stein on New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio's doomed housing plan. De Blasio, Stein notes, is an advocate of inclusionary zoning, a policy prohibited in Oregon, along with rent control, rent stabilization, and real estate transfer tax, all policies that have been used elsewhere to provide for more affordable housing. Inclusionary zoning, as Stein explains, is an extremely popular program among housing experts and advocates and is becoming something like the country's consensus housing policy. Hundreds of U.S. municipalities have adopted this approach, including Boston, Washington, D.C., Denver, San Diego, and San Francisco. The details vary from case to case, but the idea is for private developers to incorporate some percentage of below-market rate units into their new developments. These units can be rented or sold as long as they are targeted toward households with specific income brackets. But, Stein argues, inclusionary zoning is a flawed program. It's not just that it doesn't produce enough units, or that the apartments it creates aren't affordable, though both observations are undeniably true. The real problem with inclusionary zoning is that it marshals a multitude of rich people into places that are already experiencing gentrification. The result is a few new cheap apartments in neighborhoods that are suddenly and completely transformed. Advocates for the houseless have also challenged the value of inclusionary zoning, noting that it will do nothing for those in the shelters and the streets and cannot possibly solve New York City's housing crisis. But many leaders in the housing movement continue to support it. They argue that some new affordable housing is better than none, and that the program can be tweaked to produce better results. End quote. As I noted, however, even the reformist policies of inclusionary zoning that Stein discusses here, or of rent control, rent stabilization, and real estate transfer tax, are currently prohibited by Oregon law. Oregon House Bill 2564 would lift some of those preemptions, and you might want to contact your state representative about HB 2564, titled Relating to Affordable Housing. The truth is, Stein continues, cities know how to create affordable housing. The simplest, most direct, and cheapest way to do it is to build or acquire public housing, and actually maintain it well. Public housing not only provides affordable homes, but takes land off the speculative market, acting as a bulwark against gentrification. We also know that rent controls are the most effective strategy for keeping private housing prices down. The strength of rent regulation is its universality. Rather than applying to a small percentage of otherwise exorbitant housing, it can keep all rents in check. Stein advocates for democratically controlled community land trusts, which generally pairs a piece of land owned by a nonprofit with a building owned by a mutual housing association, which sells or rents the apartments at low costs and with limited outside management. If people can use these tools to take land off the market and develop permanently affordable alternatives, they can effectively decommodify their housing and reclaim community control. The solutions are out there, he notes, but the political will is not. Politicians and policymakers treat housing like a puzzle to be solved with the right balance of subsidies and profits. But affordable housing isn't a mystery, it's a contradiction. It can't be done in a way that benefits both capital and workers in equal measure. There are ways to do it poorly but profitably. There are ways to do it well, but they're not profitable. End quote. Of course, the politicians and policymakers Stein mentions are not the only agents involved. I turn now to some selections from a 1968 essay by Ian MacDonald in International Socialism on Housing, the Struggle for Tenants' Control, in which he describes a history of rent strikes in the early 20th century UK. Quote, in strike after strike, the tenants took complete control of the buildings in which they lived. At the end of the strike, the tenants often signed a clause with the landlord so that, if the landlord did not carry out the repairs properly, the tenants would take complete control of the management and would themselves collect the rents for this purpose. In at least one case in London's East End, this actually happened. The strike movement spread throughout the country and successfully pressured hostile governments to extend rent control and make other concessions to the tenants. The struggle between landlordism and tenants is a continuous one and will continue so long as the provision of housing is dominated by profits. End quote. In Portland, groups currently working to support and organize with tenants include the Portland Solidarity Network and Right to the City Portland. We need housing policies and tenant organizing that confront capitalism while providing a genuine social good. For the Old Mole Variety Hour, this has been Fran Michel.
I'm Joe Clement, your host for the Old Mole Variety Hour. We just heard Fran Michel bringing us the Well Read Red. I'd like to add just one more group to the two that she mentioned. If you listened to Positively Revolting a few weeks ago, you would have heard Tori Abernathy and Nick Caleb describe three renters' assemblies that were to be held on the 24th, 25th, and 26th of February. And while I will provide a fuller report back in the weeks to come, I'd like to say that we did meet and had very inspired, engaging, and far-reaching discussions about our experiences as displaced and dismayed renters, and how we can connect to ideas and lines of action and groups like the Portland Solidarity Network and the Right to the City Coalition, among others, that are working to organize tenants to confront capitalism and demand housing as a public good. We have not settled on a name yet, though we are planning on meeting again in the first week of April at one of the Multnomah County Public Library's meeting rooms. We'll tell you more about it on the Old Mole in the weeks to come, or you can keep track of it by going to portlandrentersassembly.wordpress.com. And now to wrap up the show, I hand it off to Jan Hawken, who's on the phone with Karen Wechter, the director of Sisterhood of Night, the opening film of the Portland, Oregon Women's Film Festival.
Welcome to KABU, Karen Wechter.
Hi. Thanks, Jan. I am very happy to be on the radio with you today.
And you'll be in the Rose City soon. So so let's talk about your film. For those who followed International Women's Day events yesterday, there are 50 shades of feminism worldwide and as many notions of sisterhood. Let's talk about the vision of sisterhood guiding your film project that opens this week.
Yeah.
Maybe start by describing the basic plot, the sisterhood of these teenage girls at the center of the story.
Definitely, yes. It's a modern version of the Salem witch trials set in today's Facebook age. We follow four girls as a controversy evolves, and rumor is spread online, and a small suburban town explodes with hysteria, and it's about that outcome. So it's a cautionary tale, and it's also based on a short story by Stephen Milhauser, and it's a great story that we had to make into a movie.
And it touches on a number of touchstone themes in popular culture: social media, bullying and harassment, parent teen alienated relationships, the question of meanness and versus cooperation in girl culture. Let's talk about that theme of solidarity and sisterhood among girls, because clearly it's in the title, and perhaps emphasizes a point made in Second Wave Feminism, that sisterhood is an accomplishment, an achievement, rather than a given that comes out of our good nature as girls or women. That rather it is something to work for. And so how do you see this theme, or how did you work with this theme of girl inclusion, exclusion, in-group, out-group dynamics among girls, which of course is part of life and part of development, but at the center of many painful experiences growing up?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, when I was working on the film with my screenwriter, Marilyn Fu, this was our first film, and in the process of making this movie, I had the pleasure of working with other amazing women filmmakers. And it's interesting because, you know, in the process of making this film, I've really learned a lot about the female. And we are complicated creatures. We're very competitive. We're naturally jealous of other women, too. And it touches upon that and how women compete with each other, and so with this film, and also getting the story that's in the film, and also in making this movie, it's celebrating the feminine mystique, and also how we have to come together as women to become stronger. And my movie really celebrates the independent woman, but together we make each other stronger, and so I'm really proud about that.
Yeah, and I think it's very effective in not counterposing the individual rebellious outsider stands alone with maybe one ally set against groupthink or group culture, that it really seems to be able to hold both of those values in a certain creative tension, where these girls have different aspirations and are struggling with different family dynamics, but also have a sense of how much their fate depends on being part of the group. And I think there's, as a psychologist, I've often been struck by how the tendency in my own field to pathologize groups, or to see a group culture as groupthink or peer pressure or the ability to lose yourself in the context of groups, which misses how much of our development is tied to our ability to have experience in groups. And I think you really have have your pulse, your finger on that pulse.
Yeah, and also the girls in the sisterhood, they're all very unique, different women, and that's what I want to celebrate. To be in the sisterhood, you have to be secure in yourself and being independent and proud of who you are, not trying to be anybody else or because that becomes boring and you lose yourself. So I'm really proud proud of that. Yes.
Yeah, and it's by the way, it's beautifully shot and has a nice pace to it. It's quite gripping. There's also this interesting theme that relates to secrets, and of course, in many parts of the world, there are women's secret societies that are structures for socialization of girls and have mixed practices in terms of how they've been criticized by women in in communities, particularly where practices like female circumcision or cutting are part of the ritual of secret societies. There's been quite a literature on that. In this film, there is the idea of secret seems to have much more to do with a developmental process of learning how to monitor a boundary or protect a boundary between a kind of inner world and the outer, which is more and more compromised in the internet age. Could you say something about the whole meaning of secrets in this film? Yeah. Because I think there is a tendency also to pathologize, to see it as a sign of something very wrong when kids hold secrets or deceive adults about what's going on.
Yeah, definitely. As you know, teenagers growing up today, their lives are online, and they're living their whole lives through social media. But we all have secrets and problems that we deal with. And each one of the girls in the sisterhood, they have a secret that's haunting them. And it's really trying to show young ladies, especially in today's digital age, the importance of sharing with their girlfriends. But not sharing online and not having the whole world know about their secrets. With women, we need our girlfriends in order to share, but yet keeping it private.
And that's perhaps part of the developmental passage to adulthood, is finding you can carry a certain amount with your peers, turn to your peers, and not turn so much to adults. And that is why kids often don't turn to adults, not only because adults aren't reliable, but because there is a way in which they're loosening some of these binding attachments. So here you did have, though, a number of these girls seem to be struggling with very, very serious concerns and troubles. Have you had any criticism that the film was a bit light on that side of things, or perhaps in an attempt to counter the tendency to kind of over dramatize and over pathologize girls' lives and secrets, the tendency to go in the other direction?
Yeah, I mean, there is a variety of different secrets that the girls share, on the lighter end, like a boy will, I've never been kissed, and then there's some darker secrets within the large group of sisterhood. They all have a weight to us. There's heavy topics in the movie. There's cyberbullying. There's a death. I don't want to give away too much.
Yeah, but I don't mean to say this is lightweight. It's certainly... Yeah, there's a little something for everybody. And it's no secret that it's playing this week as the opening film and for the Portland, Oregon Women's Film Festival, also called the Power of Women Festival. And you'll be there, right? You'll be here.
Yes, I know. I've never been to Portland, so I'm really excited. It'll be great to open the festival. And I've just never experienced that city, and I've heard so many great things about Portland.
Well, thanks so much for being with us today. This is Jan Hawken talking today with Karen Wechter, director of the Sisterhood of Night, that will be screening at the Hollywood Theater this Thursday. Thanks so much.
Well, that's all the time that we have for today's Old Mole Variety Hour.
I'm Joe Clement. I've been your host. Thanks to Jan Hawken and Karen Wechter for talking about Sisterhood of Night. Thanks to Bill Resnick and Alan Weinrub for finishing their conversation about community versus corporate energy production. To Alan Weider for his documentary about Studs Terkel, which happens every second Monday of the month. This month was about his political influences. And thanks to Fran Michelle for her well-read read. You can tune in next week from 9 to 10 to hear more news, reviews, and interviews from the Mole's Radical Perspective. And you can listen to past shows by going to kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour in a day or two, where you can listen to individual segments or the whole show. Up next, we're going to hear, up next is Locus Focus with cutting-edge news, views, and interviews with Chris Andre. And after that, Barbara Bernstein, host of Locus Focus, is going to be talking with Eric Duplass, policy director of the Sightline Institute in Seattle. They're going to be talking about the Koch brothers and their plans for the Northwest and what we can do to stop them.
Tune in to Talking Earth, a show dedicated to showcasing our local poetry scene. Join hosts Patrick Picard, Barbara LaMorticella, and Walt Curtis for Talking Earth on the second and third Mondays of each month from 10 to 11 p.m. More information can be found on kboo.fm under schedule.
And you are tuned to KBOO Portland. Coming up is Air Cascadia with Chris Andre. She is our master of headlines, interviews, and commentary. And stay tuned for that.